and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you so much for joining me, as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, hello, Liz. Thank you very much for talking with me. My name is Leslie Page. I'm professor in midwifery, and I've been professor for many years. And I qualified as a midwife in 1966. And
before my birth, actually.
Yes, I know. I didn't used to talk about it too much, but now I think it's something to be proud of. And I'm so proud to be a midwife, and I'm still fascinated and love it.
Oh, absolutely. I was only 2 years off, so I'm not that far off. But that's it. You're one of the grand mirrors of midwifery, and especially midwifery research. So we look in traditional acknowledgement, we acknowledge the elders, past, present, and future. And I think we have to do that within midwifery as well, because you are still the movers of midwifery and the shapers of midwifery are still around. And so we have to acknowledge the contribution that you've made, so that we can keep making that contribution as the world changes.
Thank you. Yes. And, you know, really, I appreciate I was working at a very exciting time. And I think that to be acknowledged is important, but it's also important for the elders of midwifery to recognize what life is like now.
Oh, yes.
But when I look back at some of the original work I did and the ideas that I put into practice, which weren't just my ideas, it was a body of ideas by many, many midwives and other people, they are still relevant today. And my work has continued to be around the idea of humanizing childbirth, which recognizes the significance of birth as a start to life. It's not just a medical event, and the huge and vital contribution that midwives make to that start of life. And of course, since then, we've built up a body of strong evidence which actually supports some of the original ideas that we were working towards.
It is something so fundamental, and let's face it, it's been the need for midwives and birthing is we wouldn't have a human race without it. So there is something that has stayed the same throughout the millennia of that birthing process, which is really quite amazing when you think about it, that the mechanics of it, whilst the anatomy has changed a little bit, the physiology has changed a little bit, our environment has changed massively. But when you think about back to the ancient Egyptians, they were birthing kind of the same way as some women are birthing now.
Yes, but we have to recognize that the culture changes the way we give birth. And so although we talk about women give birth in the same way, in fact, we're changing it dramatically.
Yeah.
Because around the world, the cesarean section rate is increasing. There are some parts of the world where women don't have adequate access to cesarean section, for example. But other parts of the world where it's increasing, we know because of the high rate that many of those cesarean sections are unnecessary. And similarly, we see more induction of labor, and we see birth moving towards acute care rather than out into primary care and the community. So I think we are on the verge of a change that could go in either direction. And midwives have a huge contribution to make in terms of looking at the evidence about what actually makes birth safe in terms of saving lives, but goes beyond that basic idea to improving the quality of care, the experience of care, and recognizing that interventions that we make can impact on the life and happiness and well-being of the baby and the mother and the family into the long term and into the next generation. And what we're facing at the moment, I think, is as important as the work to reduce the impact of climate change, mm-hmm. because it is about the survival of the human race. And when we think about the survival of the human race, we also have to think about positive mental health, supporting people
Absolutely.
To have mental health, to be happy and confident when they emerge from birth or their childbirth experience. And that will have an impact on relationships within the family, future relationships, and within the community. Mm-hmm. So it's the quality of that human race, the ability to work in relationship with others, to be productive members of society, and so on. And birth has an impact on all of these. And at the moment, we think very, very narrowly. And my view is that we need to see things differently. We need to see the broad view of the world and birth and its impact. And so I have one question that I keep asking. How might we ensure that every baby being born, every woman becoming mother, giving birth to herself as mother, every other parent, every family, has the best care possible that enables them to be healthy, have well-being into the long term, a happy experience, the possibility of experiencing joy and delight, and also has access to good medical care, because medical care is absolutely essential. Mm-hmm. And so we have to think differently about these things. And that, I think, that question, that fundamental question, takes us away from some of the polarization that we're seeing at the moment. Mm. The whole debate about normal birth versus cesarean section and intervention in birth. If we start to concentrate on what makes this the best experience, the best start in life for the baby, the woman, the other parent, then we'll get away from the polarization and we'll start to look for the research that helps us answer those questions. And some of the research is off the radar screen. For example, the impact of the physiology of birth on the relationship, the attachment between the mother and the baby. So it casts our sight in a broader direction and a different direction, to move away from the terrible polarization that's taking us right off course at the moment. Mm.
And I was talking to somebody yesterday, and they were talking about the need to understand the differences between variations of pregnancy and birthing versus complications.
Variations
are not everyone is going to birth. If you're wanting to talk about normal birth, physiological birth, it's not always going to be the same. There are variations due to different things, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a complication. And so that's importance, which is that kind of blends into what you've just said as well.
I think that's really interesting, and it's a good way of thinking about it. And one of the things that's happened is that there has been a focus, particularly in the United Kingdom, on the term normal birth, actually feeling like a judgment to women who didn't have what's called a normal birth or a physiological birth, and feeling guilty because they didn't have this normal birth. And so there's been a lot of discussion about what should we call it? Should we call it physiological birth? Should we call it a straightforward birth? And I think to think about variations rather than normal, abnormal is really important. And, you know, when I qualified life, it wasn't easier, but in many ways it was more straightforward. And, you know, we simply talked about a spontaneous vaginal delivery. We didn't use the term birth then. We used spontaneous vaginal delivery. And I think that it was just so much more straightforward. And now we have to think about language and the way it influences our care and our experience. But yes, I really like this idea of thinking about variations rather than complications.
Well, I have to give that credit to Rachel Reed. She was the kind of, we had the conversation about that. Let me take you back to 1966 when you qualified. What got you into midwifery in the first place?
Oh, I love telling this story. Well, I was a nurse, and at that time, nurses actually usually went on to do midwifery if they were going to make a career in nursing. And so at the end of my registered nurse training, and it really was training at that time in London, in England, I automatically applied to do midwifery, and I applied to the Simpson Memorial Maternity Pavilion in Edinburgh and started my midwifery education in 1966. And at that time, we had 6 months which was focused in the hospital, and we had 6 months, or much of 6 months, that was focused outside of the hospital in the community. And so I actually had what was like a real life natural experiment for one person, because I experienced life in the hospital, which had already moved to the kind of factory system, the acute care system. And for example, all babies were breastfed. Hardly any babies were bottle fed at that time. We would take babies out to their mothers in the ward for them to be breastfed every 4 hours, a la Truby King. And then we would collect them up again and put them in the nursery. Mm-hmm. And we would have about 10 babies on a trolley, and we'd line the babies up on the trolley and wheel them out to their mothers, and they'd be breastfed. And then they would come back into the nursery where the pupil midwives would look after them. And we had to get, I think it was 20 births at that time. We called them deliveries. And what would happen would be you would be on a ward, and there was a kind of flashing light up on in the corridor. And it would flash. Normal delivery, because you had to get 10 normal deliveries before you went on to abnormal deliveries. And everybody would run down, pupil midwives, medical students, and you had to be the first into the room. Oh, and really what you did was catch the baby, but, you know, you could count it as a delivery. So there you were, this kind of immense critical period of human life when the baby is coming into the world. And this pupil midwife, often very green, running into the room to get all gowned up and to catch the baby. But then we went onto the community, onto the district, as we called it. And I was in Collinton Mains in Edinburgh, and I lived with the community midwives. It was like call a midwife. And lived in an old farmhouse, and we attended home births. And so for the first time, I saw women in their own environment, in their own home, surrounded by their families. And I experienced the calm and peace of a home birth. And I've got lots of funny stories to tell about those experiences, but I won't get into those now. But really, this gave me two views of birth. And I think I've carried with me this experience of home birth throughout my career. And of course, now there are many midwives and not very many doctors who've experienced home births.
It is. I mean, COVID has made the numbers increase with home births, because they didn't want to go into the hospital because of COVID going through. And I know it's increased home births here in Australia. But we've also got the opposite. We've got people who are home birthing outside the system because they don't want that medical system. They don't want that rush. They don't want that highlights and kind of like constant movement. So the difference is quite polar in the experience, with just the noise, kind of like physical and emotional noise that is around women who are birthing.
I agree. Much of my work, though, has actually been about making hospitals more humanized, because there are some women who should go to hospital, And at the moment, the vast majority of women go to hospital. I do feel that we need to make home birth, access to home birth, more normal. And also birth center birth, either in the hospital or out of the hospital. We have to make access to that more normal and focus on the research that indicates that for women without complications, in fact, it's safe for the baby and much safer for the woman in terms of avoiding intervention and quality of experience. But yes, I agree, home births went up a little bit during the pandemic. But in many parts of the United Kingdom now, the home birth services are being suspended because we've got a problem with staffing. We've lost a lot of midwives since Brexit and since the pandemic, and midwives under a lot of stress. So I agree, I think we should open up home birth, make access easier, talk to women about the advantages of this kind of birth. And, you know, very simply, when women are seeing, when midwives are seeing women for the first time, doing what we call a booking interview, we should ask, where would you like your baby to be born? And make sure that women know that they have options, and ask them to look at the evidence and introduce them to the evidence so that they can really weigh up what would be best for them and what would make them feel safe.
Because home births, still a large percentage of the Dutch are still have much more increase in options for home birthing. But the Scandinavians do it as well, home birthing more so than hospital birthing.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that there are many parts of the world now where home births are more common than hospital births. And I think even in the Netherlands, there are some difficulties in terms of two different groups of midwives, what they call a more technical midwives who work in the hospital and the midwives who work outside of the hospital in their own practices. So I think around the world, there is a universal push by some of the policymakers to actually push women into institutional care and birthing. But it's as if the institutional care in itself will make birth safer. But there are many parts of the world where, for example, the hospital might not have staff.
Yeah.
There might be a hole in the roof. You know, there aren't the facilities, and sometimes the care is disrespectful. So I think what we need to do is focus universally on high quality, good experience, safe care, wherever it happens. But also make sure that women have access to all forms of care, whether it's at home in a birth center or in a hospital or consultant unit.
And I think that's the greatest to equity, is regardless of where you are, regardless of where the venue is, you should have high quality care.
Yes. And the question is, what is high quality care? Because some of the polarization we're seeing now in many parts of the world is taking us back to safety being saving lives. Of course, saving lives is fundamentally important. It's critical, but it's basic. And we need to go beyond that to think about the quality of experience, access to care, which is best for the woman and her baby and family, but also the kind of care that will support well-being and positive, happy life into the future and into next generations. And it's very complex. The thinking behind it is complex. Research is complex. But we have to move beyond binary thinking. This isn't either saving lives or giving a good experience or a good start to life. They are one and the same thing.
And I think that intergenerational consequence, that intergenerational trauma that can follow through is starting to be understood by a lot of people. But it is such a grand concept to get your head around, that the way that you are going to parent and the bonding and attachment that you have is actually very much related to the way that you were brought up, to the way that your parents were brought up, and that trust within the system. We see it a lot with First Nations. We see it a lot with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in Australia, that the intergenerational consequences has a big impact on their relationship with health services now. So for a lot of women, if pregnancy is their first entry into the healthcare system as a whole, if things go wrong within their pregnancy and birthing journey, they're not going to want to bring their children in as when they should. And so therefore that stops that relationship from happening in the future, which then gets brought onto them because of that subconscious growing in that first 7 years.
You're absolutely right. And I think it's such a big issue to get our heads around. You know, the trauma of Indigenous people in Australia and Canada, I'm particularly familiar with. But I think it's really important because sometimes it feels like such a big issue, such a big problem, that we don't know where to start. And so I think it's important that we can recognize that birth is an entry point for an intervention which heals relationships and which supports more positive relationships in the future. And so if I were a politician thinking about making amends for the harm that has been done to Indigenous people in the past, I would actually think about putting a lot of resources into birth services and looking at what could make those services appropriate to the people being served. So for Aboriginal people in Australia and New Zealand, and actually indeed in Canada, birthing in their own country, birthing on their own land, recognizing their link to their land, but also supporting people in the community to give the kind of care that is best, that recognizes their values. And that can work in a number of ways. But it's also thinking about communities where there's extreme poverty or extreme variation in ethnicity, or where there has been violence in war-torn countries.
Absolutely.
And actually it starts with relationships.
Yep.
It starts with relationships between the people caring for the woman and her baby and family, but also relationships of administrators, leaders, politicians with the people providing the care, and talking with them about what would help them to provide more humane, more positive services, which will give us a better future.
I think we might kind of come back to PhD and continue on this journey, because this is interesting. We're hearing so much about the issues and the hassles and the things that are going wrong within the healthcare system internationally. Every country's got their issues for a variety of reasons. So let's kind of focus on the positive. Let's focus on what are the small things that we can do from an individual point of view to where we can start getting some groundswell to start making some positive changes, and at what level could different changes be made? Because you've had interactions with different levels, with midwives on the floor, with management, with curriculum, with universities, with organisations, with kind of governments. So what are some of the kind of tips and tricks that you could recommend that we could start small and continue this positive change to start turning this around?
Well, let's start with the student midwife or the midwife just going into practice, a newly qualified midwife. I think where I would start would be listening to women and their families, really listening to them, really talking with them. And it can be difficult because we've now got, you know, all a tick box culture. But actually, it doesn't always have to take a lot of time. It's using open questions, looking at the woman, listening to her. How do you feel about that? What do you think about this? Have you considered this, for example? But then I think it also means that we have to have the skills and the knowledge and use compassion in our care for those women. And that applies at absolutely every level. So maintenance of skills, staying up to date with research, staying up to date with your skills training, but also being able to communicate really complex information in a way that the woman can understand and help her seek the information that she requires. But then I would say it requires some courage and it requires asking questions. Why do we do it like this? Why do you do that? I noticed that you did such and such a thing. Why was that? And I've always loved working with student midwives because they make me think about what I'm doing. And, you know, I was practicing, doing hands-on practice till 2014. And since then, I've been in clinical areas in different parts of the world. And I learned so much from watching the student midwives and talking with them. So I think listening to women, but then we can bring listening to women and the public to a higher level. Mm-hmm. And what the United Kingdom has done really well is listening to the public, maternity voices, partnerships, and from the change in childbirth policy that I was involved in developing, led by Baroness Cumberledge in 1993, we talked about the importance of listening to women, involving them in conversations about the care that they want and need, but also talking to the community and having the community involved in the monitoring and planning of maternity services. And we now have Maternity Voices Partnerships, NCT, National Childbirth Trust, Association of Improvement Maternity Services, and Maternity Alliance were all important developing policy. So we can take that listening to women from the individual level with individual women up to a much higher level and the development of policy. Now, we've now moved into a more complex situation with listening to the public, because actually there is polarization in the public. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some of the public voices that actually are pushing for more intervention, that are actually pushing against continuity of carer. And, you know, how do we deal with that? And how do we listen to the expert voice? So I think the next step is, how do we balance the expert voice and research and the public voice? And that's something that has to be thought about at a much higher level. It's the same situation in climate change. You've got the scientists, you've got public voice, and you need to bring them together in some way. In terms of leadership, you know, I didn't have a grand plan. I did midwifery. I started my qualification. I started my midwifery training in 1965, qualified in 1966, and actually went back to nursing for a little while. And it was only when I went to Canada and in the 1970s, early 1970s, that I went back to midwifery. And it was because in Canada, they had no regulated midwifery. In fact, to get midwifery care, you had to move outside of the healthcare system and you were cared for by lay midwives. And just by chance, I got to know an obstetrician, Bernd Whitman. And I'd met him at a conference in the north of Canada and traveled back with him to Vancouver. And he said to me, I want to set up the first midwifery project to demonstrate that midwifery would be safe in the healthcare service in Canada. And I want you to join us. And eight of us, four midwives who'd been qualified in other countries and four obstetricians, they were actually fetal maternal specialists, joined forces to set up the first recognized midwifery project in the healthcare service in Canada. And I said to Bernd, you know, I'll need to upgrade my skills. And he said, come and work with me. And I upgraded my skills and then worked with Tina Teer, the late Tina Teer, close friend of mine, dear friend, who's just died, Elaine Carty, Alison Rice, and myself, and four obstetricians. And we naturally set up continuity of carer. So we cared for women in the antenatal clinics because we did all the care in the hospital during labor and birth and afterwards. But what drew me into it was that I'd been a part of the women's movement, one of the early women's movements in Canada. And it seemed to me that giving women autonomy over their own bodies, over their own experience, was an important part of the emancipation of women. And, you know, that was the time that we had the Boston Women's Health Collective, Our Bodies, Ourselves. The women's movement was growing. And so it became a political thing in a way. Mm-hmm. But I love the clinical practice. And through knowing women and their families through the whole process, I began to learn about the consequences of my care.
Mm.
I learned that things that I did in antenatal period would have an impact down the line.
Yeah.
And this was when I became absolutely fascinated by the use of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, we didn't have the Cochrane Library. We didn't have internet. I think there was internet, but it was very basic. And so you had to look things up in libraries. And so women would ask us questions. Why am I not allowed to eat and drink in labor? When, you know, if I was running, I would eat and drink before I ran and, you know, keep myself hydrated and keep myself nourished. And so I started to look at the evidence. And you couldn't just go to the library. It was hard to know what to look at first. And I had been at a conference and I'd learned from some midwives in the Bronx that they had actually done some research, looked at the research on why women weren't allowed to eat and drink during labor. And they found, in fact, that it was counterproductive and, you know, advocated that women should be allowed to drink fluid and eat to desire during labor. And so, you know, I had to look at what they called the Gray Journal and the Green Journal in the United States of America, talk to these midwives. And we actually managed to change policy.
Excellent.
By talking to the anaesthetists. And so we changed policy and we started to change policy on a number of levels. We had women squatting and out of bed or squatting on the bed. And we used to actually lock the door because the norm was for women to lie in bed with their legs in stirrups to give birth.
Yep.
And what we did was considered to be so bizarre that for a long time we locked the door. You know, when we had women out of bed and walking around and squatting, and we developed a squatting bar. Penny Simpkin helped us design it to put on the bed so women could squat in the bed and so on. So I became absolutely fascinated by midwifery. So it was being there at the center of the world with the woman giving birth to her baby, the next generation, working with her and her partner and the family and learning what it was like for them. And it was a combination of the politics of change, because you can't imagine the letters we received about this movement to develop midwifery in Canada, because it actually affected obstetricians and general practitioners who thought that they would lose their income.
Yep.
But there was support from obstetricians and general practitioners too, and from the public. And so there was huge consumer involvement. Close friend of mine, Louise Mangan, who became a United Church minister in Canada, she was at the forefront, a lot of community activism. So it was a terribly exciting time. So I don't know, Liz, where I started with that and where I'm going, but I just wanted to tell you about this experience of helping establish regulated midwifery in Canada. And now, of course, most of the provinces of Canada and the territories of Canada have regulated midwifery with different models. But a number of the models have at their heart continuity of carer, which, of course, has been the theme of much of my professional and research career.
Let's go back to that, because you have been a consumer of research, but then you started creating it yourself, and then you started formalising your own research and following in that path. So how did you get into your PhD?
Well, my PhD actually came very late in life. I mean, I've had quite an unusual career, and it's partly because when I went back into midwifery, we weren't an academic discipline. There had been degree courses in nursing for some time, and midwifery was rather later than nursing. So I went from my experience in Canada. I was headhunted to be director of midwifery of the John Radcliffe in Oxford, which was director of midwifery for the whole county of Oxford, which was the John Radcliffe Hospital, 5 community hospitals, and all of the community services. And I had learned about the need to evaluate the service. So with our project in Canada, the hands-on clinic, we called it the hands-on clinic for nursing practitioners, and then it became the GRACE midwifery project. I had kept data.
Yeah.
You know, it was very, very basic. How many cesarean sections were there? How many assisted vaginal deliveries were there? How many epidurals were there? We didn't have. It wasn't a large group. So we looked at some bad outcomes, and we had the women and their partners interviewed about the experience of care. So at that stage, I began to realize that we need to research changes. We need to evaluate the changes. And then, of course, I told you the story of looking up the research about why we should allow women to drink and eat to desire in labor and birth. When I came back to the United Kingdom, because I was born in England, there were a lot of things happening out there in the wider world that were critically important to us. First of all, in Chalmers, Murray Enkin and Mark Kearser were developing the Oxford database of perinatal trials, later to become the Cochrane Library.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of interest in what we called evidence-based medicine.
Yeah.
Later to become evidence-based healthcare. So the whole idea of the need to evaluate treatments or interventions to see if they did good or harm was really important out there. We also had the Midwives Information Resource Service, which was actually the first digest of research in any discipline.
Hmm.
It was the first digest research. So out there, the culture was changing. The culture was changing on the belief that people should be able to choose the care that was best for them based on the evidence. And when I came to Oxford, it was very close to the National Perinatal Epidemiology Unit. I knew Ian Chalmers, Mark Kearser, the late Murray Enkin really well. Met with them regularly. My husband was involved, had a crucial role in developing the Oxford database of perinatal trials, effective care in pregnancy and childbirth, and then the Cochrane Library. So I was living and breathing this stuff. And I didn't have a PhD. I had a master's in nursing education. But one of the things that we did in Oxford was develop the first degree program. And it was direct entry midwifery degree program at Oxford Brookes University. It was a 4-year course. It was fantastic. It was phenomenal. From there, I actually got the first chair in midwifery. It was a joint chair between Queen Charlotte's Hospital and Thames Valley University. It's now the University of West London. And I was appointed really on my joint work of leading services, because we made huge changes in Oxford. Mm. We developed team midwifery continuity of care. We developed a philosophy of care. We based our care on evidence. And based on, and then I was appointed as the midwife who joined the expert maternity group that wrote and published Change in Childbirth. So I was appointed the first chair of midwifery in the early 1990s. But I still didn't have a PhD myself. But I was actually setting up PhD programs, and I had developed, and then later as professor, I did a huge cohort study of continuity of care, a one-to-one midwifery. And at Thames Valley University, we had a lot of support from Lois Crook, who was a visionary leader, who was dean and then became was put into a high position in the university. And Chris McCourt came to work with me. She's now professor at City University. And we were doing research, but we were also setting up master's programs and then moved on to setting up PhD programs. We set up the Center for Midwifery Practice. And so working with other people who had the skills, we actually provided the opportunity for higher education for midwives around much of the world. Recently, I've been in Iceland, where I was given an honorary doctorate, a PhD in midwifery, and Japan, for example. And we actually had leaders from many parts of the world who came to do their PhDs with us.
Amazing.
Then eventually I learned, you know, I'd gone beyond the stage that I could do a conventional PhD. Yep. I'd done a lot of research. I'd influenced policy. And then I learned about PhDs by publication.
Mm-hmm.
And got the opportunity through Jill White at University of Technology, Sydney. And I've worked with them for years and have links with them. And I applied to do a PhD by publication.
That's most appropriate, really, when you think about your career's work.
Yeah. And it was a wonderful experience, because what you have to do is you have to put your publications together, and then you have to write a long essay of 10,000 words or so to bridge your publication. Mm-hmm. And I had books, I had research papers, and so I'm looking at them in my bookshelf at the moment. I had a box, a bound box that I put my books in, and a bound folder of my publications. And I set about writing this essay. And I started with the myth of Copper Woman from First Nations in Canada, and what it was like to be pregnant and give birth, because this myth actually, and you've talked to Rachel Reed, I think that she would understand this, this myth actually brought to life the enormity of the change that happens in the woman, the ambivalence, the joy, the ambivalence, the rite of passage. And it says it all in a way that we can't. And so this myth actually started, and then I moved through my experience of why I was interested in continuity of care and one-to-one midwifery, and why we changed policy in the way that we did. But if you move from myth to the research, the policy, you get a very reduced view of birth.
Mm-hmm.
You get a very reduced view of the impact of the care the woman receives, the environment she lives in, the way her community, her family respond to her. And so it kind of led into this nuanced, very deep view of what childbirth is about. And so I was really pleased that I did my PhD in this way by publication. And I'm still proud of it. Sometimes I go back to it It's on the UTS website from 2004, working with women in childbirth. And it did help me. It helped me bring my ideas together, and I think has led to my interest in humanizing childbirth. And I have to give credit to the Brazilians, because humanizing childbirth started in South America, but I spent a lot of time in Brazil from the early 2000s. And they were the people from whom I learned about humanizing childbirth. And at that time, I thought we only needed it in countries that had the most abusive childbirth systems or the most extremely high cesarean section rates. And then I began to realize, actually, we need it around the whole world. So my life has been complicated. I did my PhD by publication. I went back to Canada for a while. I came back to the United Kingdom, where I actually took on another couple of director of midwifery roles, because I wanted to influence practice directly. And then I became president of the Royal College of Midwives. Mm-hmm. And I traveled much of the world. If this was visual, I'd put up a map of the world and the places I've been to. And somebody asked me the other day, what's your favorite place? And it's really hard to say, because all I can say is that wherever I've been inspired by people who really wanted to make childbirth better, who wanted to give the best start in life. And the commitment and the struggles and the work that they put into that, it's not just midwives, it's doctors, it's leaders, it's politicians, it's government. But actually, there are real challenges facing us.
Mm.
And from there, towards the end of my presidency, I was asked to do a talk on the medicalization of childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a talk on the medicalization of childbirth and, you know, went into the sociological writing about it and so on. And then at the end of it, I thought, but this is just too negative. Actually, we need humanizing childbirth to rehumanize childbirth, where it's become too medical. And so then I started to develop ideas around humanizing childbirth. And I'm working with a lot of different people. I'm not going to name them all here. But there is a huge body of people interested in humanizing childbirth. And we're starting to do more work on that, develop the domains of humanizing childbirth to recognize the significance of birth and how important the start of life is, not only to the baby, the woman becoming mother, the partner, the family, but us as communities and society. So my really complicated life, it's really hard even for me to follow it, has led to this kind of different view of birth and of life.
What was it about the Brazilians in that changed that so much from your point of view? What did they say or do that made such an impact on you that's still affecting you now?
Well, I went to the first humanization of birth conference in Fortaleza in Brazil in the year 2000. And it was a conference that changed my life. You know, I have been to thousands of conferences. But I went to this conference, and at that time, tourism in Brazil, even that recently, was quite complicated. There was a lot of violence and, you know, tourists got a lot of warnings about going there. And it was the vitality of it. And my friend, Eloisa Lessa, was one of the leaders in that conference. And it was a conference brought about by doctors, by leaders of the humanization of childbirth movement in Brazil. And it brought people from all around South America. And first of all, I learned firsthand just how difficult it is for people in many parts of the world, how extremely difficult it is. For example, we would meet with different midwifery associations or people groups from different parts of South America, and they would say, we can't talk about the mortality rates. We would be shocked if we talked about that.
Yeah.
I learned that in Brazil, women, when they went into hospital, had no option of pain relief. They couldn't take a companion in with them. The services were extremely dehumanized. But I saw the ability to influence government and to form what they called the Cigonha Network, the Stork Network, and the effect in actually changing the law to have women able to take companions in with them when they went into birth, setting up humanization of childbirth services. And later I went and worked alongside people in these humanization of childbirth services. So the power of these people and the vitality of it. And I think I hardly slept, because not only were we involved in intense discussions, and I led a lot of the writing and publication of the sessions later on, but we also learned to dance samba and went to some of the favelas.
Imagine.
And so I think I had about 4 hours sleep every night I was there. And I remember going home, and I was aware of the intense difficulty, but I felt so alive. I felt so vibrant by meeting these people who were so intensely committed to making childbirth better for women and their babies and families. So it made a huge difference to me. And I've been back to Brazil a lot, and I just love it. We've got so much to learn from them. It was wonderful.
And I think that's one of the important things, is that we can turn our eyes away from anything that is not in our own mother tongue, because it's easier to read whatever your mother tongue is to learn another language to kind of read it. And I know that as Australians, a lot of us as Australians are really quite, I suppose, arrogant in a way that we speak English and Australian, and that's probably it. But we don't have the multiple languages that other people have. So you can risk looking down on people who try to publish in English as a second language. I would love to have a service where my service was, I'll actually help you kind of like improve your paper. If you've got English as a second language, give it to me. I'll help you kind of like improve it so you can publish it, because the information you're sharing is fantastic. But we kind of like, we don't have enough resources to share that information, especially if we start talking about journals and cost of publishing and access and things like that. But we're missing out on all this information because we can't do that ease of communication.
That's really important. And I've been peer reviewer for a number of journals, obstetrics journals and midwifery journals and more generic journals. And sometimes I read a paper and the English just isn't quite right. And I don't have the time to do the editing. So I think actually somebody providing that editing service would be really important. But I want to also look at the other side of this. And I became aware of this when I was president. And I don't know why I wasn't aware of it before. But there are many countries where midwives don't speak another language. So they don't have journals in their own language.
Yep.
They can't actually read the literature in their own language. And they don't have this huge knowledge base that we've got in midwifery. And we should be so proud of it. We've got a huge knowledge base. They don't have access to that. And the way it helps your ideas and your understanding and your practice. I mean, think about me in Canada, you know, having to go to the midwives in the Bronx, the nurse midwives in the Bronx, having to look things up. Even that was difficult. But to have not had it in my own language, I couldn't have gone any further. I would have just accepted that women shouldn't be able to eat and drink in labor. And this knowledge that we bring to each other is so crucially important. You know, I will never forget in Canada, we had a big conference called Midwifery as a Labor of Love. And we brought, and this was run by a consumer group, and we brought people who developed nurse midwifery in the United States of America, because they were our neighbors. And it was from learning from them that gave us the courage to move forward and the ideas to move forward. So actually that seeding of ideas, that courage, that support. And I just want to say one thing. Sometimes as a researcher, you can help other people so much. Early in my career, I'd learned about the importance of the one-to-one relationship in midwifery.
Yep.
In fact, I'd learned about it in nursing because I was in intensive care nursing and it was nearly all one-to-one there. And I wanted to do work to actually spread continuity of care. And I met Justice Hofmeyr from South Africa, who writes a lot of Cochrane reviews. And this took huge courage because the response to it was vicious. It was vindictive. It was as if you were going to do something that was going to kill mothers and babies. And I talked to him about it, and he told me about ongoing research that he was doing that wasn't published yet, that actually showed the effect, the impact of women having doulas that they knew caring for them throughout pregnancy, labor, and birth, and so on. And talked to me a little bit about some of the work that was going on, and talked to me about the impact that it had on marriages, on relationships in the family. And it gave me the courage, actually, and the perseverance, because it can get so tedious. I mean, I am still writing about continuity of carer.
Yep.
Started writing about continuity of carer, I think, in the 70s. I'm still writing about it, and I'm thinking, surely people must know this by now. But you have to keep on talking about it. You know, I had a big clear out of my house. I threw away hundreds of letters of policy statements that I've done that basically said the same principles over and over again. Of course, we've now got all the research.
Yeah.
So it's the courage and the perseverance. And people who are in academic work could do so much good by volunteering to edit an article, or talking to people and saying, talking to a student midwife or a newly qualified midwife or an aspiring researcher saying, I'm really interested in your idea, tell me about it.
Yeah.
And then supporting them to persevere, to understand the tedious nature of it, because it isn't all exciting. I mean, I've talked to you about exciting things, but at the back of there are years of sitting up late at night, rewriting, writing and rewriting a paper, writing letters to people. So I think that our ability to support and encourage others is really important.
Which leads me really, I think, nicely into the fact that you said yourself, you've been writing for almost, let's say, 50 years on continuity of care and been around that. We know that, and I think a paper just came out, I think I saw it this week or last week, that continuity of care can save 22%. It's 22% cheaper to kind of look after women. We know the outcomes are better, including those humanizing outcomes, that the mental health is better, the relationships are better. It's not just about the not having the tear and the kind of like the physical outcomes. It's more the psychological and the holistic outcomes. How do we bring those principles that we know work, how do we bring them into the hospital system? The hospital system is never going to go away. We are going to have majority of our women for the foreseeable future giving birth in hospitals. How do we make that better so that we can reduce the moral distress on midwives and increase that humanizing birth experience for the women and families?
Well, look, Liz, you've got some of the best studies coming from Australia. So I would say build on the studies, but understand that this is a complex change. And not all midwives have to work in continuity of care because we will always have core staff. So I think it's really important, first of all, to know how continuity of care best works. And it works best where you have a named midwife for every woman, a primary midwife for every woman, but she works in a small group. In the United Kingdom, I think we talked about up to 8 people, but I think probably 6 is best. We know then that the named midwife should provide most of the antenatal care, but when she is away or off sick or having leave or something, her partner or her buddy comes to see the woman and they're backed up by this group. We know that forming a genuinely authentic group rather than a pseudo group where things can be discussed in depth, there can be reflection on practice. Is this working well? Isn't it working well? Why isn't it working or why is it working? But also having some fun together. We know that those groups need to have enabling management rather than controlling management and have professional flexibility to work out how they're going to provide those services. We know from the Mango study and other studies in Australia that midwives don't have to work 24 hours, 7 hours a day. They can have time off, and it's important that midwives do have time off and book their schedule a long time in advance so they have a life outside of midwifery. We know that they need adequate resources, so if midwives are off sick, there has to be some kind of replacement. So basically, we know a lot, and I think that the important thing is that we learn from others about what helps provide effective continuity of carer that provides care focused on the needs of the woman but is midwife friendly.
Yeah.
And midwives may want to stay in continuity of care for their whole professional careers, or they may want to move in and out of it. That is absolutely fine. But it's interesting, isn't it? We know that continuity of care is associated with a nearly 25% reduction in preterm birth.
Mm-hmm.
We know the physical advantages. You've talked about the psychosocial advantages. So why haven't we got it everywhere? Well, I think that services are up against it in terms of resources. And that makes it difficult. But also, it's a really complex change and it needs strong leadership. But, you know, we know what would reverse climate change, and we're not really doing all of the things that we should do to reverse climate change. We know what will help women and babies and the other parent and the family have the best start in life, but we aren't actually providing them everywhere. So I think it needs leadership, it needs some courage, it needs midwives on the ground to say, I really want to work like this. And in Australia, particularly Griffith University, we now have Jenny Gamble here.
Yes,
lucky
you do.
For us. We know that if students do follow-on care, if they do continuity of care, they're more likely to want to work in continuity of care when they qualify. So actually, we've got a lot of knowledge. And we just need to have the courage and the perseverance to put it into practice. And it's interesting. Sometimes I think I just can't talk about this anymore. But talking to you today has really helped me. And I've just been following the news on Gorbachev died.
Yes. Yes.
And they're talking about his courage in changing the world, really. And I think that it has to be that courage that we have and the persistence to make a change that's critically important to all of us.
Mm. Are you still writing your autobiography?
I am. I'm trying to.
Yes. In amongst everything else that you're doing.
I know. And part of the problem is my life is so complicated, you know, I can't start writing about these things. And I think, where do I start here? At the moment, I'm kind of focusing on my own birth and coming into existence during a world war, because I'm thinking about what it's like for babies being born of Ukrainian parents at the moment during that terrible war. So yes, I'm still trying to write my autobiography. At the moment, it's called Love, Life and Birth.
Most appropriate. I could like literally talk to you for hours, but we won't, because you've got a life to get onto and a day to, the sun looks like it's starting to come out in your neck of the woods as mine is settling down to go to sleep. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Liz. Thanks so much for talking to me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.